Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. What a week. The county manager wants to withhold $56 million from the school system until CMS can offer statistical proof of improvement. A city councilman walked back previous comments, asserting that being in the minority isn't so bad when the majority is represented by dummies. Oh, and did I mention the unmentioned pay raises for the mayor and city council? How we fund the arts is getting confusing and contentious. Herd immunity is becoming a fairy tale, and the streetcar is running late yet again. What does all of this mean? Well, we have a panel of experts here to help us. Here to discuss this are Claire Donnelly from WFAE. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner from WBTV. Back. How are you, Nick?
And better than ever. Good morning.
Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning.
And a man who would never be suspended from social media, WSOC's Joe Bruno.
We'll see about that.
As I mentioned, budget week. So on Monday, the city manager made his recommendations, and on Thursday, county manager Dina DiIorio did the same. Council and county commissioners will approve a final version in June, and while there are no tax increases in the offing, both of these presentations made news. DiIorio, for her part, demonstrated that it wouldn't be budget season without tension between the county and Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. This time, it's a $56 million ultimatum from the county manager.
We're giving them, you know, a half a billion dollars to educate the children of Mecklenburg County, and we expect to get some outcomes for the money that we give them.
Joe, I'm going to start with you. Was there any sign this was coming before the county manager kind of laid it all out yesterday?
Well, during the budget retreat, the county commissioners made it pretty clear they are not happy with the number of low-performing schools. And we have heard from some speakers during public forum over the past couple of weeks saying that CMS really needs to get their act together and improve career readiness for the students that are coming through the pipeline here. So there was some hints that some action would be taking, but $56 million is kind of like an eye-popping number to be put into hold and for be held hostage essentially until CMS produces a plan that is to the county's liking.
So it's not only that the money is being withheld and that the county manager wants certain standards met, she is in some ways leaving it up to CMS to figure out what those standards are?
Essentially, the county wants the CMS to produce a plan and present it to them, and the county will basically hold CMS accountable and make sure that they follow this plan to improve conditions at these schools. They're not expecting immediate action, like they aren't expecting the schools to improve right away, but they want some action steps that they can follow.
And I think there's also a subplot to this in that, what is it, something like $18 million, I think Dina DiIorio said, had been overpaid in essence to CMS, and what was the reasoning there?
Basically, DiIorio claims that CMS overprojected the number of students by about 7,000, and then when you do the math, DiIorio says the county actually paid CMS $18 million more dollars than they should have received last year.
Now, the response from Superintendent Ernest Winston came on Twitter, quote, "To say I understand the county's position is to mischaracterize my sentiment. I do not understand how increased student needs doesn't translate into additional support from everyone who has a stake in the success of children," end quote. So I guess Captain Obvious here can draw the conclusion that the schools and the county are not playing well together, and they're not anywhere near playing well together.
No, and I actually thought that was kind of a tame response considering $56 million, which actually pays your salaries, on hold. You know, that also is a shot at Dina DiIorio, because in the news conference, someone asked, "Did you tell the superintendent about this?" And she said, "I did. I gave him a heads up before I presented it." And he said he understood and that he was disappointed. And he is saying, no, I don't understand why you're doing this.
And one last point before we move on to the city budget. I think the county manager also said that this money will be withheld, but it will not affect anything going on in the classroom or the students or the teachers. Do we have a sense of whether CMS agrees with that?
Truthfully, I think it's too early to say. It's a lot of money. It is in the administrative section. So it is about $27.4 million for school leadership, $11 million for human resources, $2.5 million accountability, and $15 million for policy, leadership, and public relations. So that doesn't sound like it has a direct impact. But remember, when the last time the county put funds in restricted contingency, CMS did have to take some action against school-facing staff members, and that was only when $11 million were on.
This is how lawsuits between school districts and county commissions happen, right? I mean, those aren't unusual across North Carolina. It happens when counties try to use the funding as a stick to get the schools to do what they want. And this has all the makings of, you know, 3 years from now, we're going to be talking about the settlement of the lawsuit between CMS and Mecklenburg County.
Okay, on to the city budget. On Monday, City Manager Marcus Jones introduced his $2.7 billion spending plan, with the pandemic still very much at the forefront.
We look at this as resilience and recovery, volume two, with a bigger focus on the recovery aspect.
So there's a lot to unpack in this budget, including finishing the Cross Charlotte Trail, 3% raises for most city employees, some employees for obviously public safety with fire and police. But the most notable item, at least initially, is a relatively small one. It wasn't part of the presentation, but if you just turn to page 385, as Allison Kuznets of the Charlotte Observer did, you'll see recommended salary and compensation increases for the mayor and council ranging from 30% to 50%. Now, it's $217,000 out of a $2.7 billion budget, as I mentioned. Should this be scrutinized?
Of course, anytime city council members have the opportunity to vote to give themselves a raise, it's going to be scrutinized. I will say this wasn't completely out of the blue. There was a public forum on this topic, and I don't believe anybody spoke on it, but this was also lumped in with, you know, four-year terms and staggered terms. So there are other changes that this governance committee was looking at. But one of the changes is salary increases to make the city council and the mayor's positions more in line with the Mecklenburg County Board of Commissioners. The reason, I guess the reason why you might want to do this is if you think that your elected representatives should not be rich and or retired, making it that other people, normal people, could pursue these roles and not necessarily have to give up their lives and, or find a new job, that this is a more livable wage for elected leaders. But again, anytime a city council member has to vote to raise their own pay, especially at large sums like we're seeing now, it's going to be a tough sell.
Nick, I want to ask you, and I know you're about, but let me interrupt you for just a second, Nick, before you make your point. Public records are your thing and transparency. And as I said, this is not a ton of money, but it's hard to look at this and not see it as something that they just didn't want to reveal. I mean, because you know it's going to get attention. People are going to be interested.
This is the paradoxical problem, right? Because here we are talking about this. Elected officials in North Carolina are deathly afraid to talk about or to raise their own pay, right? Because it looks bad. It sounds bad. If we could give ourselves a pay raise, we would, right? And people would rightfully think that's bogus, right? But back to the point that Joe just talked about, that results in wages for elected officials staying flat and under market rate. I mean, if you look at what the council is getting paid versus what the amount of work we're asking them to do, you know, we have the same problem with the North Carolina General Assembly, the salary for which is still like $23,000 a year for what is basically a full-time job. And how are we expecting people to want to do that? And how are we expecting to get the best and brightest to come be a public servant if you literally can't live? And so, yes, it's stigmatized, but if you think about it from my perspective, someone who digs through campaign finance reports and investigates influence peddling, right? What does this result in? People maybe living off campaign contributions, which is legal in North Carolina to an extent. And is that better than, I don't know, just paying someone of something that they could actually afford rent and a car on? Ask yourself that.
So, I mean, I guess we're into a situation where we have a double standard, as you said. anytime a politician is going to vote a raise for themselves, they're going to get hammered, most likely. But at the same time, I think that when you don't discuss it as part of a budget briefing, it's going to make some voters and residents suspicious too. Like, hey, why didn't you tell me?
Yeah, it's a, just, you know, be transparent. You could argue, well, they had the hearing, so it's not like it was a secret, right? I mean, this isn't a new concept for the city council. Isn't this one of the first things Braxton Winston brought up?
Yes.
Like right after he was elected, right? Years ago at this point. And then they had the budget briefing last year. So you could argue, but I agree too. Why don't you just at least highlight it and mention it and put out the good reasons why it should exist instead of doing it the way it happened? And now you look like you're trying to hide something.
And City Council Member 7 out here, they had an independent group come up with recommendations and they are adopting those recommendations. So they could always just say that, oh, we aren't raising our pay. A group told us we should do this. So maybe now people will start saying that since I said it out loud, but that is what happened in this case.
Joe, you, we were on a call on Monday before the manager made his presentation when he kind of goes through with some of the media about what's about to happen and this issue about the Joint Communication Center that has been talked about for years arose, and you pointed out, or you asked rather, what's the sunk cost of not doing this? So what is the sunk cost of not doing this?
$14.5 million. That's just in the trash can. The city had these big plans going back late 2010s to build a joint communication center. It would have held police communications, fire communications, possibly 311. The project was constantly scaled back. And, you know, in about 2019, I think a lot of media outlets did stories about how it was on pause and it didn't look like it was moving forward. And now the finally just pulling the plug on the project, and they're going to use the money that they're saving by not finishing it to take care of other things like fire infrastructure and finishing the Cross Charlotte Trail.
And Glenn, I wanted to ask you, this budget also includes what we had heard hints of, which is that the Arts and Science Council is largely being moved away, at least from the grant making, to the larger museums and performing groups. What's been the reaction from artists themselves and those arts groups?
Well, there's been some opposition to that, as you might imagine. Some of the artists have said publicly and in a letter to City Manager Marcus Jones and City Council that they wanted a seat at the table, if you will, to talk about this. What the city has proposed, or at least what the city manager has proposed in the budget, is effectively a three-year plan that would see the city contribute roughly $6 million per year into arts funding. That $6 million per year would be matched by private donations from organizations, companies, for a total of $12 million per year to fund the arts. That would be a huge increase over what has been going to fund this sector of the arts in the past. But as you pointed out, rather than funneling that money through the Arts and Science Council, which in the past has made those decisions.
Hold that thought for a second, Glenn. We're going to take a break and we're going to hear the rest of what Glenn has to say on the arts. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
On Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing the local news roundup with Joe Bruno from WSOC, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Claire Donnelly of WFAE, and Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, who I not only interrupted, I completely mistimed him as I interrupted him, so I apologize. Bad host. But go ahead, Glenn. You were talking about the arts and how this funding will shape up with the city and private donations.
Yes. What I was saying is that while under the proposed budget, there would be much more money for a certain sector of the arts. That money would not be funneled through the Arts and Science Council, which traditionally has made those grant decisions. And so there's been some pushback from the Arts and Science Council to some degree, as well as from the local arts community. I think some of the individual artists and some of the community groups, they're concerned that this is an effort to protect the big arts institutions, the big museums, the major performing arts organizations, and that and I think they're concerned that they will be somehow left out or diminished in this new budget proposal.
I thought it was interesting that I wrote a little bit this week about the private match side, Glenn, and they've raised 40% of the $18 million. But part of the presentation to companies is that in the fourth year, when the city should have a long-term arts funding plan and strategy in place, the private money goes away and would just go to, not just, but it would go to exhibits and other sort of one-off events. And their money would be replaced by some portion of existing tax revenue, likely hospitality taxes. I mean, that's noteworthy because you're also looking at Discovery Place and arena renovations and whatever happens with NFL. So that could set up an interesting political conversation, I would think.
Yeah, this is kind of a total revamping of how arts in Charlotte, how the arts sector is funded. As I mentioned, this is a 3-year plan. We're only time will tell how it eventually pans out. So far, as you pointed out, the private sector has really gotten behind it. They've contributed, I think, about $7 million so far. Seven out of a proposed $18 million over 3 years, and what's interesting there is that sector of giving from the private sector had been dropping off under the Arts and Science Council. So it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out.
It's also interesting when reporters are in the room, and Republican City Councilman Ed Driggs discovered that this week. He and Tark Bakari spoke at a Young Republicans meeting last week, and a reporter from Axios Charlotte was in the room, published a story on Monday of this week that included comments Driggs made about the city's 2040 comprehensive plan. Driggs and Bakari, of course, are the only two Republicans on the 11-member council. They have played a pretty high-profile role in delaying the 2040 plan from being voted on in April to being voted on in June in hopes of having changes. So what Driggs said was that the original proposal was, quote, basically an attempt at a socialist takeover of the city of Charlotte. He said that at the Young Republicans meeting. And he also told the group, quote, smart people can outmaneuver dumb people. Here's what Driggs said at Monday's council meeting after the story had been published hours earlier.
This was an occasion on which I vented. It was not my intention that it be public. I didn't expect that it would be. So I want to apologize if any members of staff or my colleagues were offended by them.
Joe, obviously you spend a lot of time around the government center when it's open and on Zoom calls when it's not. I mean, Driggs is known for calling for civility and decorum on council. You know, how will this episode stand out? Does it have shelf life beyond us talking about it for a few days?
I'm not sure it does. The comments were inappropriate and disrespectful, and you know, for Councilman Ed Driggs frequently tells his colleagues to be respectful at the dais when they're debating city business. So they were wrong. He apologized for them. I don't think many council members, though, are going to hold a grudge against him for saying what he did.
Glenn?
Yeah, but that's probably true. Charlotte is not known for being overly political in that way. But I guess I would point out that this is really emblematic of something we're seeing nationally. As this nation, and I've talked about this in the past on this show, as this nation continues to evolve demographically, as people of color continue to gain power and influence in government, we're seeing resentment. We're seeing pushback from people who traditionally held power, and that is what we saw in those comments. You know, it's unfortunate that it was that he made those comments, but I think they reflect the sentiments of a sector of our society that simply does not want to see this country evolve racially and socially. We're seeing it in schools in terms of efforts to stop certain curriculums from being taught, and we're seeing it play out as well in how the 2040 plan is being talked about and in fact dealt with.
Claire?
Yeah, I was also going to say it also kind of underscores that you need, if you're a public official, you need to always, you're a public official, everything you say is public. So sort of hiding behind the idea that you didn't know there was a reporter in the room, doesn't really hold up because you were elected to represent the public. So it kind of just underscores the importance of that too. I think it's a reminder for city and county folks that, that you're a public official.
Nick?
Here's what I'll say that I think is notable about all this, outside of the comments that, clearly shouldn't have come out of any elected official's mouth, is the fact that we actually got what sounded like a sincere and genuine apology. And when was the last time we heard that, whether or not it was prompted by, a reporter who picked up some remarks he didn't mean to be made public? When was the last time we heard any politician actually seem to show some contrition for something dumb that they said? So that was somewhat refreshing amongst this otherwise stupid incident.
And he also did not blame the media for what he said. He took responsibility for what he said. I wanted to mention Tark Bakari, who also spoke at that meeting. He is also a Republican on council. He had a statement on Twitter also Monday, quote, "I don't think any of my colleagues are dumb. I have a lot of respect for anyone who's willing to serve. It's not easy, but I do think some policy ideas won't effectively address the challenges this council has pledged to tackle, and that's where I'll spend my time," end quote. Stop me if you've heard this one before. The opening of the streetcar has been pushed back. How long has this community been waiting for the next portion of the line to open? Well, we spoke with the project manager.
It's been 84 years.
Well, maybe not that long. Here was the projection that Transit CEO John Lewis gave back in January for the opening.
I think we will have revenue service in that late April to May timeframe.
Joe Bruno, I believe today is May the 7th. Where is that streetcar?
Who knows? I mean, they haven't even started testing this thing in the daytime yet, and it is so difficult to just get a straight answer from CATS. I started asking about this last Monday, and I did not get an answer until Friday, essentially, that I was looking for anything helpful. I had to basically pry the information out of them for them to say that, yeah, the streetcar isn't going to open.
You're not saying that the answer was late, are you? You're not saying the answer was delayed.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
But basically they say that there are still issues that need to be resolved. And I will point out that last Friday I followed up with what are those issues? And it's this Friday now, and I still don't know. So here's an example of how difficult it is to pry information from CATS. But basically there are issues that the contractor needs to resolve before they turn it over to CATS for daytime testing. And then the streetcar eventually is going to open, they're saying, by August.
By August. Okay. We have a promise that is from, the promise is not from Joe Bruno of WSOC, but the reporting is, he's part of the roundup panel today with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Claire Donnelly from WFAE, and Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro. This might be the longest we've gone in a roundup in the past 14 months without discussing the pandemic. It is unfortunately still with us. So here we go. The county has recently released data on vaccination rates by zip codes. It showed that the wealthiest neighborhoods are getting shots at much higher rates, 71% in Myers Park and Eastover. That's zip code 28207. And 20% in 28212 in East Charlotte. And the differences in median income in those two neighborhoods, $115,000 in Myers Park Eastover, $46,000 in 28212. County Health Director Gibby Harris said this week that the low vaccine rates in some zip codes aren't for lack of trying.
We have been intentionally having smaller clinics in those areas, with a number of different churches and other organizations to try to be accessible to the population.
Claire, any surprises with this? Did we know it was heading in this direction?
I think not a major surprise, at least not to me. I think we sort of knew that people who were really eager to get the vaccine were sort of hitting the point where everybody who really wanted it initially has already gotten it. And we keep hearing from health officials that they're sort of seeing just a slowdown in urgency among folks. And as Gibby said, they've been trying to sort of push to make it easier for people, whether that's going into the communities where they already are. And then they're also trying to build trust and trying to, you know, have it come from or have vaccine information come from people, the people in communities already trust. So they've been trying to work with churches, community centers, other leaders and folks to really kind of bring the vaccine to people, as opposed to relying on them to sort of come to where the vaccine is. So I don't think a ton, not really a surprise there.
Glenn, we've talked a lot, in essence, ever since the vaccines have been available. In fact, we talked before that when it was testing. Testing was the big disparity between ethnic groups, racial groups. Did it stand to reason that it would also be a large chasm between income groups?
Well, it has happened. That has happened. I don't know if it was inevitable, but for whatever reason, there is a disparity between not just income groups, but in terms of racially, who's getting the vaccine. I've not looked at the state numbers in a few days now, but when you look at the state numbers, the overwhelming majority of the people who've gotten vaccinated so far have been white or of European ancestry. Those numbers are much lower for African Americans and other ethnic groups, and only time will tell if this is entrenched resistance or if they're just kind of taking a wait and see attitude.
Claire, Gibby Harris also spoke this week about establishing, a permanent COVID-19 division in the health department. Do we have any idea what that might entail and what kind of cost we're looking at?
Yeah, so she said that at least initially, it'll be about $13 million in state and federal money that they've gotten for like coronavirus sort of focused money that they're going to put toward that. And she gave a kind of grim, I thought, presentation to county commissioners this week, just sort of outlining how they're preparing going forward. I mean, it looks like the coronavirus is not going away anytime soon. She said that the county is planning on, you know, dealing with it for the next 2 to 3 years, and they really can't, according to her, keep using the same people. They need to really kind of, as she called it, normalize COVID within the department. So just basically thinking about going, and this is something we're hearing from a lot of folks, right? A lot of doctors, and sort of like, what does the future of COVID look like now that it's going to be around for a while? We were thinking, oh, we'll have to do this for a year and a half, and then we'll just get back to normal. We're just going to ask our staff to, you know, put in these long hours, but it's going to go away eventually. And it sounds like basically, according to her, that's not going to happen. And they're focusing on staff burnout. Like, they really don't want their people to be working really, you know, long hours and getting exhausted. She said some folks at the beginning of the pandemic quit the public health department because they didn't want to have to respond to COVID. So they're looking to hire, I'm not exactly sure. I think it's around 20 or fill around 20 positions. We're not sure yet what the breakdown will be between existing folks who will transition out of their temporary roles into permanent ones. And how many new people that they'll be looking to hire. But she said that they were going to be talking about that yesterday and today, and then have a more kind of formalized announcement early next week.
And as far as COVID-19 and vaccines, Governor Roy Cooper was in town. This week he said during a tour of a medic vaccine clinic that he's sticking with his target of having 2/3 of North Carolinians vaccinated before lifting the indoor mask mandate.
Vaccines are our way out of this pandemic and coming out stronger on the other side. And we need to do everything we can to make sure we can get as many shots in arms as possible.
So, Claire, I think this week we surpassed 50% of the state with at least one dose. How much is the pace load? Is it likely that we're going to hit that two-thirds number in June?
So I would say the majority of people I've talked to are a bit pessimistic about hitting that two-thirds goal by June. I think even Secretary Mandy Cohen, the state health secretary, has kind of indicated she anticipates the mask mandate will probably hang around, the indoor mask mandate will probably hang around through June. Vaccine rates have slowed big time. So in North Carolina, just looking at some of the data day over day this past week, the rate only went up by between 0.1, 0.2% every day, which is really, really slow. In Mecklenburg County, we went up this data. I mean, the data is as of last week, but we were going up about 4% every week. So it's just not enough. We're just, you know, slowly chipping away at that. But again, that goes back to the kind of the lack of urgency among folks. So,
Glenn?
At Bank of America Stadium, in the early days of the vaccinations, you could go there and you had police officers directing traffic. There were long lines stretching down the sidewalks and even around the stadium or going around the stadium. I was uptown earlier this week and all of that was gone. There were still people going in to be vaccinated, but there were no long lines out there. There was no waiting.
I'm actually going to take the break at the right time. So stay with us here on Charlotte Talks, and Claire is going to tell us more about vaccines right here on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, and for Mike Collins, we are continuing with the local news roundup with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, Joe Bruno of WSOC, and Claire Donnelly of WFAE, who was about to educate us more on COVID-19.
Yeah, I feel like with vaccines, I come in off the bench, right? COVID. So I was just going to say to Glenn's point about Bank of America Stadium, we're also hearing that, you know, the county is moving away from the mass vaccination sites, right? Like they're just not drawing the people to those places that they used to. So Bojangles is going to close later this month. Joe, I think you reported Medic is going to close next month, the Medic site that they've been running. So they really are trying to, you know, as Gibby Harris would say, or Meg Sullivan would say, get kind of creative about how to get to folks who might be hesitant or just, you know, I also keep thinking kind of about the supply demand thing. Now we have all these vaccines. So people might be like, there's so many vaccines. I don't, you know, it's not as rare. It's not as exciting to kind of get your shot. You can just get it wherever. So, yeah, I was just going to point out that, you know, they're sort of shifting strategies kind of away from, you know, how many people can we vaccinate in a really short period of time to what are the smaller places we can go to try to meet people where they are and get more people shots.
Have we heard anything about whether this dramatic slowdown in vaccination rates has led to more waste? You know, that was a big concern. You remember it was like, hey, we're going to send out the bat signal. We have five doses. Joe, you're the king of this, right? Are they able to preserve the doses that they have?
I think according to the county, they haven't had to throw any away. But Joe, you were going to say something?
Well, the providers are getting better at timing when they can pull the shots, you know, out to defrost and such. But I do think more doses are being wasted now than they were in the heyday of vaccines.
And we've heard nationally that there are some providers who are kind of asking Pfizer, Moderna, can you kind of redo how you package these vaccines so we don't have to get six, or so we don't have to, if we open a Pfizer vial, we don't have to find six people to get it within a short period of time. We'll see kind of what ends up happening at the manufacturer level.
We also heard some not so good news this week about herd immunity. Mecklenburg County Medical Director, Dr. Meg Sullivan, said the agency is rethinking what the finish line looks like.
I don't think we can focus on getting to zero cases, right? I think it's focusing on getting as many people vaccinated as possible, doing the things we know that work, and trying to get that back the virus as in as low level as possible.
So Claire, does this, I guess, logically lead into why Gibby Harris is saying we're going to have to make some things permanent?
For sure. Yeah. And I think also, I mean, there was talk, herd immunity has sort of been this magic number, but it's super fluid. Nobody has ever been able to say for sure what percentage of people need to be vaccinated to get to that point. And it seems to keep shifting and changing. So to hear Sullivan tell it, they're sort of moving away from trying to hit that goal and just focusing on more shots in arms. I guess that's sort of the same thing, but I think that, yeah, just sort of preparing to have, like I said before, COVID be around for longer. Comparing it to the flu is not perfect, but the idea of we'll get boosters every year, it'll hang around is sort of how a lot of people are, a lot of health officials are starting to think about it. Like this is going to be kind of endemic for a bit.
Now, this week in Elizabeth City, the funeral was held for Andrew Brown. He was the unarmed Black man who was shot and killed by sheriff's deputies on April 21st. The service came days after a judge had rejected a request to release police body cam footage to the public. And Reverend Al Sharpton made comments to the effect this week that the video will be the same whether it's seen now or whether it's seen in 30 days or 45 days. Nick, as you know well, this is based on a 2016 law that was passed here in North Carolina. What is the reaction at the General Assembly? I'm assuming there are probably at least two different camps, but what is the reaction, and is there anything in the works to try and change this policy?
There are a lot of layers of answers to your very straightforward question, because we can't ever just have an easy something from the General Assembly. So before this shooting in Elizabeth City, Democrats in the General Assembly had introduced a bill that would change the body camera, that would change the law surrounding police video and skew it more towards release that essentially need to be released within 48 hours. And there are some caveats in there. That was introduced. Here's the interesting part about that. That is introduced and being pushed by Democrats who largely voted for the 2016 bill that makes the body camera video currently secret. And Republicans have pointed to the fact that that bill in 2016 that made body camera video secret received wide bipartisan support. I mean, I think all of 9 Democrats voted against it in both, that's in the House and the Senate. For now, Republican leaders in the General Assembly are standing by the law, but saying maybe we need to make some tweaks. They've, of course, not elaborated on what those tweaks are, and they've not been open to really discussing what those tweaks might need to be. The good news is that, and I did a story last week with State Senator Danny Britt, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, powerful Senate Republican, who said, look, we're definitely talking about this law just from the fact of what happened in Elizabeth City. And so this is the first time that we've seen legislative leaders even really be willing to engage on this law that's not been working since the moment it passed. Not been working from a transparency standpoint. When you look at all the hoops you have to jump through, even if you get video, you know, you still have to file $200 court case. You have to go to court. You have to argue to a judge. The judge has to review the video. It has to be, and then the judge rules whether it should be released or not. And even in cases where judges are ruling video is released, which happens very frequently, you know, that's still what in that process that I just said sounds like it's ensuring quick and transparent and timely release of video. It's not.
Well, and Nick, I know you've covered this closely. I mean, on this show, we've talked about it plenty of times. One aspect of this, there are many aspects of it I don't understand, but one aspect that I don't understand in relation to what's going on in Elizabeth City is we've had all this discussion about the body cam video. It's not going to be released, but the family can watch it. I think that's part of the law that the family can watch, right? But I believe family members said they had seen something like 20 seconds. Can you kind of fill in the blanks on that?
I don't understand this either. Under the law, people in the video or their family representatives in a situation like this are entitled to view portions of the video relevant to them. And so why the county had determined that they were only able to see 20 seconds, I don't understand. That's not what the law says. It's at odds with the law. The judge then ruled that the family could see all of the video, but that the officers' identities had to be blurred in the video they were seeing. I don't understand that either, because there's not a provision for that, for the judge to be able to make that ruling. Also, by law, the identities of the deputies involved is public record and came out the day after the hearing in response to requests for personnel information, because again, that's explicitly public record. And so, you know, also the judge ruled that the media didn't have standing to seek public release of the video. Again, a thing that is just black and white, 100% against what the law says. The law clearly says the public can seek release of video. Media outlets, there was a media coalition that had formed to request the video be released, and media outlets qualify for the purposes of seeking that video. So, you know, the biggest hurdle and problem that I've said with this law for 5 years now is that it relies on judges and going through the court system. And what is happening in Elizabeth City is exactly reminding us and demonstrating why going through judges is wrong. I'll also point out, Eric, that he entered that ruling more than a week ago now. When he entered that ruling last Wednesday, he said he'd have an order by Friday. You'd have to have an order to appeal the decision signed by a judge. The judge, here it is the next Friday. The judge still hasn't entered the order. And so now the judge is, you have to wonder if it's on purpose, delaying entering an order so we can challenge his incorrect and legally wrong ruling.
That's the voice of Nick Oxner from WBTV. He is with us on the local news roundup. Also, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Claire Donnelly from WFAE, and Glenn Birkins of Q City Metro. I have one other question on this particular story for you, Nick, which is we know that there is an SBI investigation, there's an FBI investigation, and the governor had called for a special prosecutor. I believe the prosecutor in Pasquotank County said no, he doesn't want that to happen. So how does that get resolved? Does it get resolved?
It gets resolved by the DA saying no. In North Carolina, DAs have immense power over what they do and don't investigate. The attorney general doesn't have any original jurisdiction to come in and investigate this. There's no mechanism to force a special prosecutor be appointed. And so there we are.
Okay. Bad news if you like plastic bags for your yard waste. This week, the city said that reusable bins or compostable paper bags can only be used as of July 5th. Among the people who were not happy with this, former County Commissioner Matthew Ridenour, who said on Twitter that, quote, liberal do-gooders make life miserable. Joe, are we going to survive the loss of plastic bags for yard waste?
I think we'll manage. So the reason the city is doing this is because, you know, when you use a plastic bag for yard waste, a worker has to get out of the truck. They have to take that plastic bag, take a knife, cut open the bag, dump all the contents of that bag into the truck. And, you know, this is a safety risk for the workers. It takes up time. It just delays responding to other yards that need attention. And then when you have those paper bags, you can just toss them right in and not worry about them. So what the city is saying is use a paper bag starting July 5th. If you keep using plastic, you risk running a $150 fine. And, you know, you can also use reusable bags like what Leaf Burrito has, or just get another trash can and put your yard waste in those.
You got to love the name Leaf Burrito, Glenn.
And we all know that single-use plastic is bad for the environment. It ends up in oceans. It ends up in our streams. It ends up in landfills. You know, it was a good move. I think it was a smart move. I applaud the city for doing it. We simply have to look for better ways to protect our environment. And this is a small step, but a needed step.
Joe?
The city is going to give out free paper bags to people who need them at the recycling centers, or you could pick them up at Solid Waste, but they also, you know, they sell these things on Amazon, they're in Lowe's, Home Depot, they're not hard to find.
You're not endorsing any of those retailers, of course, but transition alert, Nick, our friend Dan Bishop is endorsing Ted Budd over Pat McCrory in the Senate race. What do we make of that move?
If you read some tea leaves, Dan Bishop, generally hailing from the Senate, the North Carolina State Senate, which never really got along with Pat McCrory, and generally speaking, Dan Bishop, an ally of Phil Berger, whose son got beat by Mark Walker long ago for a congressional seat. And so who does that leave in the race of three?
You're saying that people have long memories, I think, is what you're saying.
You might pick that up, and you might be correct.
Joe, I want to go back to where we started this program. There's one piece of budget news that I did not get to, which is this. Marcus Jones said, when asked about the American Rescue Plan Act, is it Plan Act or Act Plan? I can't remember at this point, but the big COVID relief package passed by President Biden, how that money is going to be spent. He referenced the idea of taking $682 million, which is all the money that the city, county, and CMS are getting, and coming up with some, you know, bigger type project. Based on how the county and CMS are getting along right now, what do we think the odds are of this kind of collaboration?
I think they're going to talk to each other, because I think they have to come up. When you have that much money, everybody has to get together and decide the best ways to spend it. I don't think that the county and CMS rift right now will have an impact on that. And I believe County Manager Dina DiIorio did indicate in her remarks post budget presentation yesterday that she will be looking forward to working with Mr. Jones and the superintendent on this issue.
So I guess the sticking point, or potential sticking point here, is that we don't know yet what expenses qualify for that money to be used for. That's what we have to wait for, in part.
Correct.
And also, is the money's not entirely in their hands, right? Isn't it going to be split?
Right. It is not. And like you said, there are a lot of different rules for what that money can be spent on. So, you know, this will take a lot of planning.
Finally, some good news, a welcome sound of normal times returned to minor league ballparks this week across the region. Here's Charlotte Knights executive Dan Rakowski on Charlotte Talks on Tuesday.
It's been challenging. It really has, but we've seen the light at the end of the tunnel.
Joe, I think you had a little coverage of the start of baseball season. We also have the new ballpark up in Kannapolis, and there's one about to open in Gastonia. So how's life at the ballpark?
Oh, it's great. I mean, I think we all missed baseball. It's been more than 600 days. And, you know, I think what teams are really looking forward to is next month, when the restrictions on capacity will be lifted and social distancing, so ballparks can bring more people into the stadiums. It'll be interesting to see if they go full house right away or reduce to 3 feet of separation. But right now, as it is, with seating pods having to be separated by 6 feet, they're pretty limited in the number of people that can get into the stadium. So it's kind of a hot ticket and a hard ticket to buy right now.
And Claire, none of that is dependent on the 2/3 of people being vaccinated. That's not connected at all to going to 100%.
Nope. And I think, and it will be also interesting to see, because we don't have the outdoor mask mandate anymore. So once you're seated in your pod, will not need to wear your mask. But I don't know if anybody was.
Yeah. Catcher still has to wear his mask, but other than that, we're all set. Yes. I want to thank our panel, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro, Claire Donnelly from WFAE, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Nick Oxner from WBTV. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us on Charlotte Talks. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.